Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is special coverage of the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. I'm Brian Lehrer. Good morning again, everyone. We are preempting the takeaway in the BBC NewsHour again today to bring you our special coverage. Here's how complicated our situation remains, or at least a little of it. Thousands in New York City are excited this morning about the return of their local subway lines. Hooray, even though it's a crowded mess in lots of places, while others in Hoboken and elsewhere are still stranded by flooding, waiting to be rescued from their homes. And you just heard on NPR News how not only dark and sometimes lonely, but also cold it's been starting to get in some of the area where people still don't have power and might want to be helped in various ways. And really, before we can deal with transportation as too big a thing, we have to have safe water. And that is not guaranteed everywhere in the area today, especially in New Jersey, where Governor Christie has issued a mandatory conserve water alert for the entire state, and 12 communities have boil water alerts because of contamination from sewage. And I want to start there for just a minute. Where is the water not safe to drink? Well, here is the list. So in case you're in any of these places, the boil advisories are for the Atlantic City area, for Brant Beach, New Brunswick, their joint water department, for the one in Independence, the Highland system in Warren County, for Teskew, Ship Bottom, Cedar Bonnet Island, United Water of Woodridge, United Water Woodridge, it's called, of Wantage, and four Vernon Township utilities. So if you're in any of those areas, please know, if you haven't heard it elsewhere, that you should be boiling water today, because we don't want anybody dying or getting really sick from contaminated water, because that's not what the media is talking about, even though those advisories are out there. We're going to open up our phones this hour to begin to take calls on how the government is doing, in your opinion, responding to the crisis. Governor Cuomo and Governor Christie and Mayor Bloomberg and the various county executives and other mayors, Mayor Booker, Mayor Zimmer in Hoboken, even President Obama, all weighing in. We'll talk later to this hour to the county executives of both Westchester and Rockland. Have elected officials learned important lessons from Hurricane Katrina, from Hurricane Irene? Are they taking care of business the way you think they should be in an emergency like this? Our call-in number today, 646-829-3980, same as it's been all week while our usual phone lines are down, 646-829-3980. We also want to know what you need. What do you need if you're in Newark, on the Lower East Side, in the Bronx, or Long Beach, or Westchester, or Rockland, or wherever you are, because maybe it's not getting through? Call us up and tell us how your government officials are doing. And tell us what you need if you're not getting it, and maybe officials will hear. 646-829-3980, 646-829-3980, or you can use all our electronic media communication systems other than the phone. You can post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or tweet at Brian Lehrer, or use Brian Lehrer WNYC on Facebook. One of the new nuisances in our area today is gasoline lines. And we go to WNYC's Bob Henley, who is in Mendham right now. Hey, Bob.
Hey.
Are you waiting in a gasoline line yourself at this moment?
It's very Nigerian. I'm at Pine and Morris across from New Jersey Transit's train station, which is shuttered. Let's see, we have about 80 people online standing with gas cans waiting to be able to fuel up for stranded cars or generators. And then we have a auto line, which I just spoke to someone. They just are finally pulling up to get fueled up, they got online at 6:30 this morning. So,
and I know when you say, just so none of our Nigerian listeners get offended, seriously, I know by that you mean it's kind of very third world. It's not what you expect to see
in
New Jersey.
Right. Hey, raw And that's the point. Handling of raw petrochemicals on the scale we're looking at does increase the likelihood of some kind of disaster. And as we know, tragically throughout Nigeria, despite the fact that it has abundant oil, that this is a common mass casualty event. And that's one of the concerns that we have here, is that people are handling bulk quantities of very dangerous materials in ways they may not be used to.
In other words, the gasoline lines, Bob, are not just to fill up your car, but to get refill fuel for people's generators, right?
Right. This is new. This is one of these things that came out of the post-Katrina Irene response. People did have generators in place. They're familiar with these. Are like in the 5,000-6,000 watt ability, and they have massive quantities of gasoline they need to keep them going, and so they've elected to do that. So I'm looking here now at quantities of people carrying, 5, 10, and then they have multiple 10-gallon jugs. So there's some issues there, and so it's not so much potentially a nuisance, but dangerous.
And this is a new danger for many of you who may have gone out just before the storm and bought generators for the first time. We know that Home Depot and, whatever store you're going to, sold out of generators over the weekend in many, many cases, and that many of you listening right now may have purchased generators for the first time. Well, these are things that you need to learn how to use and use safely. So be careful handling gasoline if this is something you have not done before. And there are other hazards with generators, too. So just make sure that in the midst of the crisis, as sort of, manic or whatever as anybody might be, that you stop and read the manual. If it comes with a manual, learn the safety precautions, because enough people have gotten killed and injured from this storm in other ways. We don't need this, too, from the things that are supposed to keep you safe and warm in your homes. So, Bob, stay there. Also joining us now is WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, who is with transit riders who are happy to be transit riders, but maybe not that happy, at Flatbush and Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Brian.
What's happening?
Well, I am at the crossroads of Brooklyn, and I'm at the Barclays Center. You may remember the arena was built at this site because it is where 11 transit lines and the Long Island Railroad converge. So what's happening today is that people are taking the subway. They are taking the limited Long Island Railroad service from Jamaica to here, and then they are lining up. Thousands of them are in line. They're going all the way around the arena, which is a very large arena, and it's taking over an hour to get onto the shuttle buses. Once they do get onto the shuttle buses are jammed here at the corner, the very high traffic corner of Atlantic and Flatbush, and they are basically waiting for a police escort to help them get down Flatbush Avenue. And I can see Flatbush Avenue down towards the Manhattan Bridge, and it is still very jammed with cars, regular buses, and these special shuttle buses. So people whose commute is normally, say, 45 minutes told me that they've already been, it's taken them an hour and a half in some cases just to get to here, and they now have to get on the bus and take it into Midtown Manhattan, many of them.
So it's good that it's there, but everybody allow enough time to get where you're going. With these bus links across the East River, with the subways not able to transverse the river as yet. And, Bob, are you on the story of the buses in New Jersey? As of yesterday, unlike the MTA, New Jersey officials weren't even speculating as to when bus service would start resuming, no less train service. But there are some buses rolling in some communities now, right?
Governor Christie's had a comprehensive briefing at last night at 7. What he said is that New Jersey Transit is like 70-75% of their bus network is up. But what happened to New Jersey Transit Rail is really something very different. You have critical parts of the infrastructure underwater. You have actual tracks missing that were pulled away by the storm surge. And you have signal problems. You have Hoboken underwater. These are the terminus points which are critical for the rail network. And so as Governor Christie suggested people carpool. He didn't come up with the same kind of direction that the mayor did, which I guess is three-person occupancy in terms of vehicles. But clearly, this is really adding to the complication because people who would normally be on train lines are in their cars.
All right. And we should note that that three-person occupancy rule for getting into Manhattan across bridges and tunnels, Richard, there is an exception, and that is the George Washington Bridge, because people, because the mayor says a lot of people using that crossing are actually going to Connecticut, WNYC's Richard Hake.
That's right, Brian. Yeah, the mayor did say that. And we also understand that they are checking. There are checkpoints on the East River bridges. You need three people. Here's the mayor.
From 6 a.m. to midnight, if you're coming into Manhattan on one of those bridges, you have to have three people in the car. We're also establishing bus lanes on key corridors and exceptions to HOV rules, including commercial emergency and paratransit vehicles, as well as buses, will be made.
And the governor also instituted the same restrictions for the Lincoln Tunnel, the Henry Hudson Bridge, and the RFK Bridge, and as, Brian, you mentioned, not on the George Washington Bridge. Also, the Taxi and Limousine Commission says taxis, liveries, black cars, and other TLC-licensed vehicles, they're exempt from those HOV regulations.
Also with us, David First from New Jersey Public Radio. David, you know anything about those buses starting to roll?
The buses, yes. The buses. Bus service has resumed on about 80% of the routes today. The New Jersey Transit bus service passengers, as you will expect, will be facing delays because so many reasons. Many traffic lights are out. Lots of roads are closed. But the buses are running. And as Bob has been mentioning, the New Jersey Transit rail service is still suspended. I mean, we're just dealing with waterlogged equipment, damaged rail lines, some washed away, and flooded train stations.
Let's take a phone call from Philip in Elmont, who I think is on a gasoline line or was. Philip, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. My name is Philip. I'm in Elmont, New York, Nassau County.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one gas station open. The lines are about maybe about 100-150 people, and
Whoa. There's
nobody directing everything. So everyone is just fighting, trying to get in for gas. It's total chaos.
Do you have power out? And Elmont is just across the border from Queens in Nassau, right?
We have no power since Monday. My mom and I are here. We have no heat, and the food is running scarce.
Philip, thank you very much for checking in. Are your local officials being responsive, in your opinion?
Well, I haven't been able to get to work since Tuesday. There's a tree that knocked out the lines on my road. I live on a dead end. And the whole entire block, everybody is just, we're sharing gas, and we're charging cell phones in our cars, but the gas is running out. And there's practically no stores open to get bread or anything.
The people in the line that you're seeing to get gasoline, can you tell if it's mostly for the cars or also a lot for generator gas?
It's for generator gas. They have the red cans in their hand, and there's plenty of cars. I mean, I was online for almost 3.5 hours, and when I got there, there was no gas.
Philip, thank you very much for checking in. We really appreciate it. We're going to go next to Dr. Tina Tan. She's an epidemiologist with the state of New Jersey to talk a little bit more about the boil water advisories. Dr. Tan, thank you very much for coming on with us on very short notice this morning. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Tell us why people in some of the water systems in New Jersey are being advised to boil their water.
Well, you know, there have been disruptions to water supply treatment potentially due to various power outage issues. And for that reason, there might be concerns with disease-causing organisms that might be present in the water for inadequately treated water.
I'm going to read the list again, and I want you to tell me what this means as far as you understand it. Does it mean the people in the cities or the towns whose names are attached to these water systems, or do they sometimes just supply part of the towns and cities or even other towns and cities? So even if you don't hear your name called, you need to consider boiling your water. So these are for the Atlantic City system, Branch Beach, New Brunswick's water department, combined water department, the Independence one, the Highland system in Warren County, Fortescue, Ship Bottom, Cedar Bonnet Island, United Water, Woodridge, and Wantage, and four Vernon Township utilities. Is that more or less your understanding?
Yeah, these are the list of the water companies that have instituted boil water advisories, at least as of today, as of now. So it's really important that residents really follow closely public announcements that will advise residents if and when water is safe to drink or use. And again, this could be changing at any moment, so it's really critical for people to keep up to date on these public announcements.
And Dr. Tan, what exactly is happening in those places to cause the order to boil water? What's the threat?
Well, you know, the water companies are monitoring the situation in their particular municipalities and, you know, are issuing these advisories, you know, when there's concern about some issues with the quality of the water itself. Because, again, the whole issue of the potential of disease-causing organisms in the water for, like, inappropriately treated water. And so for that reason, they're issuing these boil water advisories to help ensure that people take the right steps
right.
to make sure their water's safe.
But is it contamination from sewage or other particular causes of these orders?
And again, you know, it really does vary according to the municipality, but some of it is just a pure treatment to ensure that those organisms are removed.
Water treatment plants down in some places, is that an issue?
That could potentially be an issue with power outage situations. And again, it will vary by the municipality. So for the specific municipalities, if people do have questions, that they can call their water company.
And on Governor Christie's statewide conserve water alert, is that a public health measure? Is that something you also follow as an epidemiologist?
Well, you know, for the purpose of ensuring that the water supply is adequate, the safe water supply is adequate, that certainly that water conservation measure is seems to be something that makes a lot of sense in this context.
All right. Dr. Tina Tan, state epidemiologist in New Jersey, thank you very much for joining us. And WNYC's Bob Henley in Mendham, you were at Governor Christie's news conference last evening where he talked about that mandatory conserve water alert after we just had who knows how many inches of rain from a hurricane. Why do we need to conserve water?
Well, it's because the infrastructure that produces the water is reliant on electricity, and when electricity is down, it can't perform its function. And so yesterday, one of the things that President Obama committed to was 100 generators that were thrown into New Jersey, and that is they're going to be deployed based on a priority list that includes water filtration plants and hospitals. And so the other piece of that is that there are places that had generators that are now running out of fuel and diesel. That's why the piece of the 500,000-gallon emergency supply of diesel is critical from the federal government. And then also the question of generators in places where they didn't have backup. Now, Brian, I want to make a point. One of the things early on in the storm, even on Saturday, that first press conference, the governor and the state police were talking about 3 days of provisions. They wanted people to set aside 3 days of food and water. So, you know, I have talked to my sources who say that some parts of the JCP&L service area, that's the Jersey Shore and Northwest Jersey and Central and South Jersey, power could be off for as long as 14 days. So that's too, is that politicians do the best they can and officials do the best they can to project forward. But, you know, disasters don't roll out based on a tabletop exercise.
Bob, thank you very much. We'll check back with you later. And Bob Henley brings up an interesting and important point. In some places, people are literally beginning to run out of food. You've stockpiled a few days of food. Maybe you're not going to have power for up to 14 days, depending on where you are. Those are the most extreme cases, obviously. And I got a text this morning from somebody I know who lives in Lower Manhattan who said, we need food in Tribeca. Richard Haake?
Governor Cuomo did say yesterday that the federal government is stepping in to provide 1 million meals and 1 million gallons of water to New Yorkers who are stranded and running out of provisions. He says FEMA will start those deliveries today.
We're getting scattered reports of senior citizens, some people in public housing who are running out of food and are in high-rise buildings and can't get out of the building because in some cases the elevator is not operational. and they're literally running out of food.
And in addition, the Army Corps of Engineers is bringing in 250 high-speed pumping devices to help clear the water from the tunnels.
And it's not only in the high-rise buildings where some senior citizens may be alone. It's not only in Tribeca. It's also on Long Island. And Chris is calling in from Roslyn. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for the coverage, and thanks for all the information.
You bet.
I just wanted to sort of keep the focus on Long Island. I know there's a lot of devastation in New Jersey, Staten Island, and the city, but people on Long Island, I mean, by the latest estimates that I was getting from a friend, I'd still 800,000, 700,000 customers on Long Island have no power, and we're experiencing some of the same things that the caller from Elmont was mentioning, that it's very difficult to find stores that are open, and where they are open, there are long lines, you know, out the door. Same thing with the gas. So we're starting to run out of basic supplies.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And, you know, Richard, one of the things that my friend in Tribeca suggested was, why not deploy food trucks to come around, at least in Manhattan, where the food trucks are plentiful, have them come down to lower Manhattan, and they'll probably make a killing and also supply people with some needed food.
Actually, yesterday, one of those halal carts was parked right outside of our building here, which, of course, we're in a neighborhood that does not have power. We have the generators, but there was this halal cart, and I saw that picture actually on Facebook, and I said, well, if I was at work, I would have ran down there and got some food.
But you food truck operators listening right now, please know price gouging if
right.
You have people over a barrel. David, first, it's so hard to know what to keep our eye on. I think we've had a good representation of that in our first few minutes of our coverage here this morning. It's so different in Hoboken than it is in Elmont, than it is in Roslyn, than it is in, Upper Manhattan and Lower Manhattan are so different from each other, the Bronx, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And if you're in one of the so many communities that are in the dark and you're hearing these things about water, you got to boil, you know, what if you have an electric stove and you didn't have water supplies, that boil water advisory is going to be a tough one to sort out. People were definitely saying have 3 days of water and food on hand. I saw lots of other people warning before the storm saying you really should have at least 10 days. And, you know, with 1.8 million homes and businesses still in the dark in New Jersey, and we're hearing it could be 7 to 10 days, maybe more, before we get power back here. I tell you, in a lot of the towns in New Jersey, I was driving around last night as best I could. Rumors really start to fly when the lights go down and people are wondering, I heard that the town is going to shut the water off in 10 minutes. And this kind of stuff starts really flying. At nighttime, it turned out this particular rumor turned out not to be true, but there's a lot of serious stuff people are dealing with right now. And when the lights go down at night, people start, the worry increases.
Do you want to dispel any particular myth? Should we play Mythbusters here on the air this morning? Is there any particular rumor that's making its way around that you think is particularly damaging? Or sometimes you wind up spreading rumors even by repeating them to debunk them. So that's always a risk. On the air, but I don't know if there's anyone particular out there that you want to reassure people about.
I wanted to speak to the generators. You were mentioning the dangers of generators. You know, buying a generator, a lot of us, myself included.
This is real, not a rumor.
This is real. Picked up generators very recently, and if you do take a look at that manual, this is a very serious device. This is not like picking up an iPad where they hand this over to you and you can play with it and sort it out.
It's not like putting new batteries in your flashlight.
No, this is not. And we were talking about the dangers of carrying around big tanks of gas and pouring it into hot generators. But these are devices that put out a very high amount of carbon monoxide. And we've had two deaths in New Jersey yesterday due to carbon monoxide poisoning from people using their generator. This was in Trenton. So this is a very real problem. This is not a rumor. You have to treat these generators very carefully.
And, you know, you point out the fact that people could even die from this, and some people even have died from this. I was speaking to somebody in another part of the country and telling him about some of the deaths in our area, that there was a death toll that I think is incredibly low, actually, in New Jersey. If eight people the figure that I've seen is correct. Not
the most
that that
recent I've seen was 14.
14. So, I mean, it's an unbelievable tragedy. And more than that, Richard, in New York, I think it's in the 20s in the city right now.
The city, 34 for the state so far.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a lot of people to be killed from this. And the person I was speaking to who lived in another part of the country said, how do people die in a hurricane? So it gets windy and it gets wet. Well, the answer is people die in all kinds of ways from a hurricane. People die misusing generators. People die coming in contact with water that has a power line down in it.
Falling tree limbs, falling trees.
A lot of falling trees.
Hopefully people will not be dying from starvation or dehydration, from being stuck without being reached by rescue crews if they're actually stuck in their homes. There's some of that still going on. So hopefully that won't be another cause of death. But the answer is that people die in all kinds of ways, and not only while the storm is raging. Let me take another call right now from John in Nutley. Hi, John. You're on the air on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio.
Good morning. I just wanted to talk about how the local municipalities compared to the state level. You see Governor Christie on TV a lot in the helicopters, and I'm sure he's doing what he thinks is right, but I've seen most of the things getting done by the local municipalities, and the local municipalities being prepared for the storm. Here in Nutley, they had the stop signs out for traffic lights that went out. So when the lights went out, there was stop signs to control the traffic. Trees, the tree department was out there cutting trees right away. The police were out marking the down lines actually during the storm. So they were really on top of it.
So you're answering my question, how are your government officials doing in this crisis? And you're saying in Nutley, pretty well.
They're doing very good. They set up the local junior high for senior citizens and people that need shelter for heat. They were very prepared, and power is getting back on. They got the power back on in the downtown area for the local ShopRite so people can get food, even though the majority of the town is still without power.
Thank you very much. Gary in Soho, you're on the air. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Ryan. I'm calling because I'm concerned that despite the fact that NYC is a lifeline for all of us down here and throughout the region, we're hearing no updates from either the government, the Con Ed itself, or from reporters at the station on the status of the blackout.
The power in New York. And no, Gary, I'm glad you brought that up. Is it my imagination, or were Con Ed officials, Richard Hague, noticeably absent from the mayor's news conference yesterday after they had been in the mayor's news conference the day before?
Yeah, that was an interesting point. I mean, I think we've only had one update from Con Ed, originally. It was a formal type of update. We've been calling them and getting the numbers, the figures each day. Con Ed says it's restored power to more than 225,000 customers in the city. This is not the state or Long Island. This is New York City since the storm ended. And as of early this morning, 676,000 customers remain without power in the city. And again, millions more upstate on Long Island and New Jersey. There was this report of once they basically can't turn on any of the power downtown until they fix what happened at that substation on 14th Street. I think they, as of yesterday, they were basically ready. You know, they can turn it on, but they want to wait and make sure that is whatever problem was there is corrected before they do that. One interesting point, it is coming back in pockets. There was a report that in Manhattan, in lower Manhattan as well, little areas were coming back. And on my cab ride down this morning, this was the first night, last night was the first night I got to go home, and coming back down this morning, sure enough, we hit 42nd Street and then 39th Street, and then all the traffic lights went out.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, it picked up about 10 blocks later for about 5 blocks. And then it went dark again.
Huh.
And then 5 more blocks.
You know, the mayor mentioned that in his news conference yesterday, that the power was starting to come back in pockets.
Yeah.
And he referred, I guess, to exactly the same thing it must have been, because he said he was driving south and the lights were out for a while. And then he hit a pocket in the 20s where the lights were on, and then they were out again.
Yeah.
As he headed south. So it's going to come on in pieces. It's like the subway system, I guess. It's going to come on here and there and here and there. And at least the subways, the MTA is announcing these lines will be operative from this station to this station, it's going to be more random, I guess, in the case of Con Ed. Now, they say that they're going by density, right? That the first priority neighborhoods will be those where there are the most people. But I wonder if there are different technical obstacles to getting power on in different places, if they can always adhere to that priority list.
I'm sure, and I expect not to have everything turned on all at once, like just like flip the switch, but I'm assuming that this will have to happen maybe even building by building in different neighborhoods.
All right, WNYC's Richard Hake, New Jersey Public Radio's David First. We'll check back with both of you later. Coming up next, together, the Westchester and Rockland County executives. Stay with us. I want to check in now on one of the most tragic outcomes of the superstorm. More than 100 homes burned down in Breezy Point, Queens. In the Rockaways, WNYC's Stephen Nesson is there this morning. Hi, Steve. Can you hear me?
Hi, Brian. I'm sorry. I'm not actually there this morning. I was there yesterday.
Right. So you've been reporting from there. And remind us, how did this happen? How did the fire start?
Well, The fire department says they still don't know exactly how the fire started, but people I spoke with there speculated that it could have either been from a stove that was left on during the storm, or it could have been an electrical wire. All the residents that I spoke with said gas and electric was still on during the storm, so many suspect it's one of those causes. I spoke with an insurance agent who's going to inspect a burned-down home, and he said the same thing as well.
And did it spread to so many homes because of the wind? The wind contains oxygen, which feeds a fire, and that was more powerful a fuel than the rain from the storm was, you know, a deterrent?
Well, certainly these are very small, close clapboard homes. Most are made out of wood. These are a lot of, you know, like beach bungalows. And one of the reasons that firefighters told me they couldn't get closer to put out the fire was that the area was flooded, so they couldn't get the trucks close enough. Also, the water pressure on the hydrants that were there was too low to really reach some of the farther homes that were closer to the shore, like Congressman Bob Turner's home, which is right on the ocean there, and was just reduced to, you know, cinders, nothing. It's just the foundation remained in a white porch there.
Were many of these summer homes or second homes or mostly people's primary residences?
Well, I found a mix of the two. A lot of people do keep summer homes there. They spend half the year there, half the year somewhere else. But a lot of people, this was their primary home. I met a couple, you may have heard them this morning, Walter and Annette Connolly. You know, this was their dream home. Walter designed the house himself on the back of a napkin one night, sort of an amateur woodworker. And this is where they lived. Their house is still standing, fortunately. Some of the newer structures that were away from the fire zone are totally flooded, but still standing. So a lot of people are grateful for that. But a lot of the burned homes, yeah, they were primary residences for people.
Where has everybody gone?
Well, fortunately, it's a tight-knit community, and everybody knows somebody who knows somebody in the area. And so from what I heard, not a single person died there, thankfully. And they're with friends, family, you know, deeper into Brooklyn, some people into New Jersey, Staten Island, various places.
Do you think that there are policy lessons from this, or is this just a fluke occurrence? If something happens in such a concentrated way, sometimes there's some kind of cause. You know, building codes weren't being enforced. The construction was shoddy in a particular area for some reason. Things were, you know, whatever it might be. Is there something that can be addressed of a systemic nature that people are talking about now to prevent such a thing in the future? Or does this just go down as a freak occurrence?
Well, a lot of people said they knew the risk when they bought a house on the ocean that, you know, waters do rise. But I think the gas and the power was a concern. People were wondering, why wasn't it shut off? Why was it still on during the fire? And I don't know what the policy is, but I suppose shutting down the power and gas perhaps could have prevented the fire. That's what people are saying there.
And that poor community, Steve, hit by a plane crash shortly after 9/11 and other things since, and now this. How do the residents feel about living in Breezy Point?
Well, I mean, everyone I spoke to, they love that place. They all talk about the tight community. I already saw signs that said Breezy's coming back. I think people love that area, and because it's on the ocean, it's quiet. It's not that far from Manhattan, but it really does feel a world away. And yesterday, people were just embracing each other, grieving, a lot of tears. I saw, you know, very big, tough firefighters just sort of walking around, you know, awestruck, dumbstruck. They couldn't believe what they were seeing. But there was always someone next to them to give them a quick hug. And so I think that sense of community really is going to help them going forward.
WNYC Steve Nesson reporting on the massive fire that burned more than 100 homes on Monday night in Breezy Point, Queens. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Our coverage continues. This is special coverage of the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. I'm Brian Lehrer. WNYC's Richard Hake is here with the latest, as is David First from New Jersey Public Radio. Richard, what you got?
Well, it's been a real tough commute this morning, Brian. That's been kind of the top story, especially here in Manhattan, as workers basically try to head into the city, especially from Brooklyn. WNYC's Fred Mogul was at the Barclays Center earlier, where he said there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people lined up for blocks in every direction waiting for those shuttle buses to bring people into Manhattan.
I talked to Joan Stewart, who was planning to drive into Manhattan. She literally had to abandon her car. She couldn't find gas anywhere. She was on empty, and she didn't want to stall out on Flatbush or on the Manhattan Bridge. She's going from East Flatbush, Brooklyn, to her job as a housekeeper at the Hilton Hotel in Midtown.
Now, Mayor Bloomberg's HOV restrictions are in effect on nearly all major crossings, and police are enforcing the rule of three or more in a car. WNYC's Jim O'Grady was doing reports earlier today from the Williamsburg Bridge this morning. He found Victor Alvarez, who was looking for people to get into his car so he could cross the bridge.
Get in the car with me and come across with me.
He was turned away by police. I guess Jim didn't get into the car with him.
Nice try.
Yeah.
David, what you got?
Well, people have been asking about power. I can tell you about in New Jersey. New Jersey's utilities are estimating how long they think it will take to restore electricity to now 1.7 million remaining homes and businesses. Public Service Electric and Gas expects to reconnect 780,000 customers within a week to 10 days. Jersey Central Power and Light says it has restored service to 30% of its affected customers. JCP&L estimates most of the remaining 830,000 households will be restored by Wednesday. It may be another week for some of the in the hardest hit areas. Atlantic City Electric, which has 77,000 outages, expects to restore service to customers on the mainland by Sunday. Obviously, there's no estimate for repairs on the Barrier Islands. Orange and Rockland Electric says about 56,000 customers are still without service in New Jersey.
David, we've been talking about the gridlock in Manhattan and some of the chaos on the streets in lower Manhattan where traffic lights are out. Do you have any reports of similar things from around New Jersey? Things are bad on Route 17 on a good day, you know, and
that's exactly it. How do you sort out what it's bad on a good day? I've seen lots of reports of big backups heading to the Lincoln Tunnel, heading to the George Washington Bridge. And as I looked at a lot of those reports, I was thinking the same thing is that could be any day.
But also with power out and traffic lights not working, I guess we should count our blessings if we're not hearing about a lot of fatal traffic accidents. But I'm sure there are snarls all over the state.
People in a lot of ways are showing incredible patience and are doing a lot, behaving in a way that they may not normally on the road, slowing down and really letting people take turns at some of these very hazardous roads. Just driving to the highway this morning, I had to take so many detours that it's getting to the highways that is where you're really kind of ducking under wires that are hanging very low over streets still, and trees that are on angles over streets in a lot of places. And when you're dealing with situations like that, when you come to these intersections where there are no traffic lights, people are being patient with each other and taking turns. Where you're really seeing tempers flaring is in these lines at the gas stations. We've heard lots of reports about screaming matches breaking out. There's this video of a screaming match in Nutley at a gas station. And the tempers are really flaring in these places.
Similarly, in New York City?
Yes, actually, I'm just looking at the wires right now out on Long Island, especially some 25 cars lined up at a gas station in Farmingdale, Long Island. The scene was the same at a station in North Amityville. Someone said they were searching for gas for 2 hours. This person is also quoted as saying the price for regular there was $4.39. That's about 50 cents higher than the typical Long Island price a week ago. And we also heard earlier from WNYC's Bob Henley, who was out of New Jersey, also reporting about those gas lines.
Absolutely. And some of these gas lines going all night long. I've seen reports of the gas lines still going at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning.
Actually, my cab driver on the way in was also talking about his cab was parked out in the Bronx, and he said there's basically four stations that gas stations that they would gas the cars up in, and three of those were not open. They were out of gas.
Let's take a phone call from Laura in Brooklyn. Laura, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling as a New York City school teacher. Nothing to do with traffic, although it may impact on,
that's
on
fine.
Our lives tomorrow.
Traffic is just one of the many things we're talking about, so go ahead.
Okay, so tomorrow students are again staying home. I understand the wisdom of that, and staff are being told to report to schools. My suggestion, and you guys may have the ears of the mayor and the chancellor, is that teachers be told to report to the school closest to where they live, or a school to which they can walk or get to, you know, with a reasonable bus ride. I live in Kensington, and I had errands in Park Slope and Brooklyn Heights yesterday.
Where do you usually teach? What neighborhood?
Well, I'm in ATR, which is another story altogether, so I'm supposed to go out to Gates Avenue tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And looking on Hopstop, that will be a two-hour journey on a variety of buses. This is assuming the buses are moving and are not gridlocked. So some teachers live within walking distance of their usual
right.
schools, but many do not.
I could see some upsides and downsides of that. I'm not sure what a principal is going to do with teachers who are not the usual teachers who suddenly show up because they live nearby. That would leave teacher shortages, I would imagine, in some of the other places. Richard, you have a thought about this?
And I've always wondered, what do the teachers actually do on the days when the students are not there?
What do you expect to do tomorrow if you report to a school?
I have no idea. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm curious, are you getting communication from the Department of Education with respect to how to get to a school if it's far away from you? And a lot of teachers obviously do commute by subways, and somebody might live in Brooklyn and teach in the Bronx or whatever it is. You just kind of have to try to find a ride or try to, you know, go with the subway system as it exists?
I guess that's what I'll try to do, and I guess that's what thousands of other teachers will try to do because, you know, we do want to get back to work. I don't know what we'll do tomorrow at a school that we usually work at or a school that we're temporarily assigned to. Are we going to be filling sandbags? Are we going to be, you know, shoveling out basements? No, I'm joking about that.
Right.
I think we won't be doing much of anything if we're just a sub, so to speak. But I'll get back to you guys and let you know. I just thought this was a simple and elegant suggestion that, I mean, I can walk. I can take an hour's walk and hit about 10 different high schools
Laura,
in my part of Brooklyn.
Thank you very much. It's an interesting suggestion, though I would be concerned about the neighborhoods where not that many teachers live and they commute too. They're going to have to get to those high schools and other things too. Richard and David, we'll keep checking back in with you. We go next to Mike Brown, who's the federal coordinator for FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Mr. Brown, thank you very much for coming on with us. Hello.
Pleasure to be on, but my name's Byrne.
Mike, not Brown, Byrne. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Mike.
No, it's Byrne. That's okay.
Okay. So so now that we've got your name straight, and I apologize, tell us about
That's
FEMA's
all right.
presence and how people can use you for help.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being on. The first thing and foremost is that people who have suffered damage from the storm need to register with FEMA. And if I may, I'd like to give you the phone number for them to call in. And that is 1-800-621-FEMA. And the numbers for the, corresponding for those letters is 3362. If I may say it again, 1-800-621-3362.
And
they
Go ahead.
They can also go online at www.disasterassistance.gov.
Who should apply?
Anyone who suffered damage from the storm or need temporary shelter or need assistance for housing assistance or things like that. If they've if their houses were damaged, and what happens there is the call taker will help them take the information in, and then we'll, if they had damage to their house, we'll send an inspector to their house. They'll meet with them and they'll figure out. And the maximum grant that they can get is $31,400. And if I may, we've already issued $1.7 million just in the few days since the disaster was declared.
Do you take into account whether people have private insurance?
Yes, of course. You know, we're the source of last resort. Is if your insurance is going to cover you, then that's a prudent thing to do. But what I would ask people to do is just because, if your insurance isn't covering everything, let us come anyway, because if the insurance doesn't cover everything, we may be able to pick up some of the gap that people are suffering with.
You mentioned if people need shelter, and that might be the first thing that some people are concerned about before getting reimbursement to rebuild. How can FEMA provide shelter to people?
Well, the way we do it is through that grant program. They can use the money that we give them to, rent a hotel room or move into another rental resource while they're taking the time to help rebuild, to rebuild and, clean out their primary residence. And the other thing is, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
All right. The other thing is, I want the people of the city of New York to understand that we're focused on essentially what we're calling the four P's. It's about people, which is this program where we ask people to call in and to register. We're providing bulk food and water that we're working with our partners in the city and the state. Got a great team, great partnership. We work together well, and we're getting the delivering food and water to those impacted areas starting today. And on top of that, the next P is pumps. We've got the Army Corps of Engineers, engaged, and we started pumping yesterday, and they're continuing to pump today, and we're starting to prioritize those areas that need to be pumped out. The third P is power. We've got generators that are going all over the place, helping out to do emergency power at this time till the regular power comes back. And the last P is pick it up. It's about debris and getting the stuff out of the roads and providing our assistance to make that happen.
Just give out that web address and phone number one more time to make sure people have it.
Great. Thanks for the opportunity. It's 1-800-621-3362. And the web address is www.disasterassistance.gov. And actually, I've got one other way. We actually have a mobile app that they can use, mm-hmm. which is m.fema.gov, and I'll say that again, m.fema.gov.
It's great to know you're there, and I'm glad you described for our listeners some of the services you can provide that some of them might take advantage of. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Our special coverage continues in a minute with Sean Trendy from Real Clear Politics, who will talk about Hurricane Sandy as an October surprise in the presidential race. Stay with us. WNYC's Bob Henley now. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with special coverage of the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. WNYC's Bob Henley traveled with Governor Christie yesterday. He's in Morristown today. Hi, Bob. Where are you exactly? What's happening? Oh, his... All right. You know what? We just lost Bob's line for a minute. Let's see. Do we have... Now, let me play a short clip of Governor Christie, who was asked yesterday if the election should be delayed in New Jersey because some people won't have their power back until after that. Now, that doesn't pertain to the presidential election, which is going to go on nationally, but there are local races for all kinds of things everywhere. This is going to be an issue, certainly not just in New Jersey. And the governor said...
Yeah, I'd like to have the polling places powered up for next Tuesday. I would like that. I'm not yet to the point where I know whether we're going to be able to do that or we're not going to be able to do that.
And now Bob Henley joins us from Morristown. Bob, you there?
Yes, I am.
Can we start on that note? Was the question about whether there would actually be a cancellation of some local elections in New Jersey? Why was he asked that question?
So this came from a Bloomberg reporter who was just, I think, asking a very salient question related to, because at that point the governor was on the podium with Lieutenant Governor Kim Guadagno, who also, as you know, because we changed our constitution, we have a lieutenant governor, which we didn't have before. The lieutenant governor is also permitted to hold one other cabinet-level position other than attorney general. That includes, she picks Secretary of State, which is a key player in the election law in what happens in New Jersey. So basically, the reporter was asking to have comment from Lieutenant Governor on the status of the preparations to the election. There are several dates that are coming up. We're a state that is an excuse-free absentee ballot state where people can vote by mail. And there's all kinds of, protocols about when things happen by when. So it was a reasonable question. The governor got pretty irate and basically dismissive and was saying, you're obsessed with this election thing. I'm concerned with, and his point's well taken, providing basics for people like we've been describing. Of course, examples, Marianne McCune's compelling reporting is happening throughout New Jersey as well. All those things are being said by our reporters in terms of folks who are in the margins. This is a particularly trying time. So that was Christie's response to that question, and then he wouldn't let the lieutenant governor answer and said, I'm not going to spitball my plan with a group of reporters. So clearly it was a sensitive point.
You had an exchange with the governor at his news conference yesterday about whether to rebuild the Jersey Shore as it was, since tidal floods are becoming more common. And he got very emotional about that. What was that exchange about?
Well, I mean, basically, we had the opportunity to fly in, as you were mentioning, in a Blackhawk helicopter over from West Trenton to Sayreville, which it deals with, it was a working-class community, the Old Bridge section of Sayreville in Middlesex County, that has had chronic flooding issues, but this storm surge was really unprecedented from the OAM workers there, by the way, who did an amazing job of rescuing 200 people from the water. They had a rush of water that was 6 to 7 feet in depth that came in rapidly and pinned people in the living rooms and sent their major appliances floating. At that point, and you would walk around these places and see that literally the force of the surge had moved the homes off the foundation, really making them, inhabitable. And then on top of that, it had created a sinkhole phenomenon where you had to be careful where you'd step, because actually you risk dropping down several feet. And so after seeing that, and then also, I mean, to the governor's credit, I cannot describe, I like to think I'm good with words, but the emotion that I saw there was, of all the years of reporting, I've never seen such a collective amount of despair with people spontaneously, uncontrollably crying and reaching out for the governor and feeling grounded by his presence. And the compassion that he showed extemporaneously was awe-inspiring. I have to say that. And they took comfort from his presence and the presence. And in fact, one local official said, well, we're now at the top of a lot of lists. So while people think that this may be a photo op, I have seen directly a psychological phenomenon that people feel observed and cared for. That said, later on, people were saying to him in real time, Governor, it's time to make these places a soccer field. Give me my check and I'm out of here. And then other people, elderly people who are attached to the neighborhood, please, Governor, help us rebuild our home. And so that's a tough thing for a politician. He doesn't want to make policy on the fly extemporaneously, and yet he has these two divergent policies. And so that was what I asked him about, was at what point is it in the greater societal collective interest of the well-being of society as a whole to basically say these places are no longer inhabitable in terms of having them be insured and having them rebuilt. And he kind of walked the line, as elected leaders have to do, where he said, well, it should be up, you know, it's I want people to have the choice to be bought out. I don't think it's a position of the government to be, you know, dictating or make it mandatory. But the problem with that answer is, if you're insisting on having people live in these places that clearly nature wants back, then they are, in essence, putting all the first responders at risk every time it floods. And these are the central questions that face us. And the problem is our framework for dealing with these things takes decades, and we're faced with, you know, these storms that are getting worse. And so that's the challenge, Brian, is the geoscience, if you will, versus our political systems.
There are so many ramifications of this storm. I'm just looking at some of the things coming over the wire right now, Bob, from around the area. For example, from Albany, state officials have determined that New York homeowners won't have to pay an insurance deductible in seeking compensation for damage from Superstorm Sandy. Laws in 15 states, including New York, allow officials to waive the 1% to 5% deductible payment if a storm is downgraded from a hurricane. So there's one example. In Connecticut, Governor Daniel Malloy just said that he will meet with U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, so it's gotten to Homeland Security, to review damage to the state. He said that Lieutenant Governor Wyman will meet with Napolitano and others. She's toured areas damaged by Tropical Storm Irene in Connecticut in the past. This is coming in from Newark, and I know you were talking about a similar thing earlier in the morning. This is about a gasoline station line stretching nearly a mile behind a Gulf station in Newark, along one of the main roads leading to downtown. The congestion was so bad, a police officer was directing traffic at the gas station. Just another example of the second day of enormous gas lines around the state. So different pockets of different communities with different levels of crisis or just inconvenience all along that scale. And I know you've been seeing it all, Bob.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that I think looking forward here is dealing realistically with what the managing people's expectations. And this is the central responsibility of government. And so we're in a situation where it looked like 7 to 10 days was what the utilities told us. Now my sources are telling me in some areas it could be longer. And so there has to be transparency. There has to be a sense of just basic honesty and let people know, because what I have seen is, and we've heard all these anecdotes from all of our reporters, people will do the right thing. People are inclined to help each other, but it's up to government to be transparent so they can manage their expectations. So if it's going to last longer, they have to act accordingly. And by the same token, I think there also needs to, we have to talk about the fuel issues going forward. I mean, that's something that I would imagine if this continues much longer, we'll have to see, you'll see the government impose restrictions on what kind of fuel, how much fuel you can buy and the rest, because I saw people loading up vans with gasoline, and there's a certain point at which those vehicles weren't designed to carry that much gasoline.
The American Red Cross says Superstorm Sandy has forced it to cancel more than 325 blood drives in 13 states and Washington, D.C., resulting in a shortfall of more than 11,000 blood donations. And there's an irony, Bob, because they need more blood for some of the people injured by the storm in some areas, and at the same time, they're having to cancel blood drives because they can't handle them.
Right, and I think, you know, the other thing, too, is the sense of the communications are a problem, and that's why I know it's self-serving, but, you know, people were said radio was dead. Well, you go into any place in this region and just say that, and you'll have a chuckle from someone that's standing next to you, because that's a problem. Situational awareness, as Marianne was pointing out, is really a problem. And so that's another question, is how do you get information out to people? One of the things that was poignant to tragic was as I left Sayreville, a gentleman who had, was trying to save his house, I said, so what's the thing I need to take back to people to say? And he said, we need information, we need to understand these structures, and we need fuel. And he's looking at a situation where, and this is something people need to keep in mind, in certain areas, if you take the water out of your foundation, you run the risk of having the house implode on you. And so what needs to happen is I think the government needs to get out information. It should have really happened maybe a day ago, flyers about what to do when your home is flooded. What is the advised procedure? Because as we've been saying, this is you have, you know, hazards that can occur as a result, even though it's not raining and the wind's not blowing, because you go into a basement where there's a live electrical line or you begin a project that you don't fully understand.
And we're going to try to get answers next hour to some of the many questions that people have. What do you do if your house is flooded? What is the proper way to use a generator? A lot of different kinds of things that we'll be talking about in a big Q&A session coming up after the news. And there are many ways that people want to help. Now, the United Way has created a storm recovery fund to help communities recover. The United Way Hurricane Sandy Recovery Fund was just announced, and it'll be used by the organization's local chapters to assist communities that the federal government has declared disaster areas. So that one just crossed, and that's just yet another to add to the list of things we've been discussing over the last few days of ways that people can help. Bob Henley, we'll check back with you later.
All right. Thanks so much, Brian.
This is special coverage of the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. I'm Brian Lehrer. We will spend most of this hour answering your questions. As I mentioned before the news, we've been doing our best to use good judgment about what aspects of this multifaceted crisis to cover. But we also know from our phones that so many of you have specific questions that we or other media may not have answered. So we will try a little experiment. For part of this hour, we will have the New York City public advocate Bill de Blasio coming on in just a few minutes to talk about whatever you ask. And, you know, we're not going to be able to answer every question, but we know that a lot of you have questions that you may not have heard the answers to. So you can use our call-in lines, which at the moment are full from my first notice of this segment coming up just before the news. But take down the phone number 646-829-3980 when we get to Bill de Blasio. First, we'll check in with WNYC's Richard Hake and David First from New Jersey Public Radio. Richard, you have a transit report?
I do, but first I just want to mention that we just got word that the Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, will travel to New York today, and she will meet with Governor Cuomo as well as Mayor Bloomberg later this afternoon, and she'll be at the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel for an update there.
And she's going to Connecticut too, I see.
And as far as transit, that's been the big story, at least the commute in this morning. We have some tape now. Earlier this morning at the Hughes Street Station, that's the connection point for the shuttle bus over the Williamsburg Bridge, we encountered MTA transit checker John Abrams helping load people onto the buses.
Shuttle bus.
So the line of people was about two blocks long, and even as some people opted to jump into livery cars that are circling nearby, Abrams was trying to keep the line orderly.
It's crazy because nobody won't let anybody get in. Everybody's trying to get in one door, and that's the whole problem.
And a dispatcher said the connection point, though, at J Street was less busy. From there, once buses are loaded, it took about 10 minutes to get into Manhattan. Meanwhile, in Jackson Heights in Queens, WNYC's Arun Venugopal had a quieter subway ride.
The train was a little crowded, but probably typical for your normal weekday rush hour commute. It stopped at every stop, but it was pretty efficient, and it got to Manhattan within 10 or 15 minutes, which is maybe a couple minutes more than extra.
And also note that HOV restrictions are in effect for nearly every major crossing, and police are enforcing that rule.
And David, you have an update from Hoboken, which is still one of the most serious situations in our area.
Definitely. Flooding is subsiding, and some residents are able to get out of their apartments, some for the first time. Roads going into the south of Hoboken, according to NewJersey.com, are now open to vehicles. NJ.com now open to vehicles for the first time since the storm water surged. A few cars were driving in and out of Hoboken along Main Boulevard and Jersey Avenue this morning. I was just speaking with Roman Bryce, who runs the blog Mile Square View, better known as HobokenHorse.com. He says the National Guard has been doing lots of evacuations. They've seen a lot of improvement. He says there's still people stranded there, and some have elected not to leave. They wanted to tough it out, but that the flooding has significantly improved. But still, the most heavily flooded area, he says, was the southwest corner. And there was still recently a couple of feet of water there, 2 feet of water there, he says. And this is a toxic mix of water. This is water from the Hudson River with chemicals, street oil, gas in its sewage. And the mayor urged people not to walk through this water. He says some people were walking through this water to get out, putting garbage bags on their legs and trying to get through. But a lot of the basements in town totally flooded, the garages, lots of lost vehicles. And they're going to really have to go on a case-by-case basis looking at these structures as they go through the cleanup here to see how livable some of these places are going to be.
It sounds like the recovery is going to be intense. And is it possible, and I get the impression from what you're saying, that maybe parts of Hoboken are basically not going to be habitable for some time to come as sections of town?
It's something we're all thinking about. It's a big question that we don't know the answer to. I think Hoboken sees lots of, you know, on a normal rainy day, Hoboken floods. This is a town that knows floods and knows how to deal with floods and how to rebound from floods. But they've everyone that I've spoken with says they've never seen a flood like this in Hoboken.
And the toxic mix that you were describing, that's part of what's new here.
That's part of what's new here. And if you had a basement that was flooded all the way up to nearly the ceiling with that kind of a mix sitting in your house for that long, they're really going to have to look at these structures and see if they're still structurally sound after being in maybe 4 feet of water for some length of time and dealing with that mix of chemicals. According to PSE&G, power is still out to 20,000 customers in Hoboken. Most of the stores and restaurants are still closed.
And Richard, I gather the mayor has his latest news conference coming up in about 20 minutes. We'll carry it live. And it's this kind of thing, maybe nothing at the level of Hoboken, but pockets of trouble, of serious trouble.
Yes, and it's interesting how close it is to where life has returned, you know, to normal. Certain areas of the city, if you, you know, travel north of 42nd Street, you would never know that we're going through some of these problems.
Richard Haake, David Furst, we'll keep checking in with you.